content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, everybody. This is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, of course, we're reading from the edition dated May 6th, 2011. Well, there's been a lot of big news in the last few days, of course, since the Week magazine went to publication at the end of last week. So we've pulled a couple of articles from the online edition of Week magazine as an update on the big news of the week, which, of course, is the killing of Osama bin Laden. The first article is entitled, Bin Laden's Death, World Reactions. Osama bin Laden may be gone, but his impact lives on. It's not just Americans who worry about what this means for the global war on terror. Here is a rundown of what writers around the world are saying about bin Laden's downfall and legacy. From Pakistan, this is great for America and terrible for Pakistan. Osama's killing has come as a huge prize for the U.S., says the Frontier Post in an editorial, but it's terrible for Pakistan. First, it's shocking that our vaunted intelligence agencies were so ignorant that Osama was holed up in the middle of a bustling city like Abbottabad. But the truly terrifying thing is how U.S. commandos pulled off the raid so near an army garrison while Pakistan's military stood flat-footed. Is our sovereignty or our nuclear arsenal safe? That's from Pakistan. Now from Lebanon. Now the U.S. should mend its ways. Osama bin Laden was merely a symptom of America's problems, says the Beirut Daily Star in an editorial. Now that he's gone, the Obama administration should attack the root causes of the deep-seated antagonism toward Washington in the Muslim world. To do that, the U.S. should stop favoring Israel over the entirely legitimate cause for Palestinian statehood. It should also stop preaching democracy while making friends with any dictator willing to do its bidding. From Saudi Arabia, bin Laden hurt Muslims too. For the Muslim world, it is like a lifting of a curse, says the Arab News in an editorial. We complain with very good reason at the spreading tide of international Islamophobia, but he was the cause of so much of it. But this is by no means the final chapter, because there are so many Al-Qaeda offshoots, so many bin Laden wannabes. His death will not end the dangers of terrorism. From Kenya, fear still resonates. Osama bin Laden's killing is testimony that merchants of death can only hide for so long, says the Daily Nation in an editorial. While Americans joined the hunt for the Al-Qaeda mastermind after 9/11, bin Laden struck the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi in 1998. Unprovoked attacks and numerous unfulfilled threats have forced Kenya to join the war on terror, if only to ensure its own security. And these harsh realities and fears live on here. From the Philippines, but this could still have a lasting effect, even if this was mostly a symbolic victory, says the Sun Star Cebu in an editorial. It does not mean bin Laden's death won't have an effect on the conduct of worldwide terrorism. The fall of charismatic, or should we say notorious, leaders always weakens the movement identified with them. Just look at the Al-Qaeda-linked Philippine terrorist group Abu Sayyaf. It has been crippled by the loss of two such leaders in the past decade. And from the United Kingdom, bin Laden's vanity did him in. For a fugitive, we sure did see bin Laden a lot. Despite being stateless, he was very far from faceless, says Mark Lawson in The Guardian. Bin Laden delighted in distributing images of himself, but considering that Islam forbids any images of its leader, Muhammad, bin Laden symbolically perverted and travestied the faith he claimed to represent. In showing his face, he showed himself to be a false prophet. The next item regarding this story, the hunt for Osama bin Laden by the numbers, nearly 10 years after September 11th, the terrorist leader has been killed, but at what human and financial cost? The successful raid on Osama bin Laden's Pakistani compound Sunday and the subsequent killing of the terrorist leader came nearly 10 years after the 9/11 attacks he engineered. Over those 10 years, the U.S. spent tens of billions on intelligence operations and aiding the Pakistani military. Here's a brief guide by the numbers. These are some pretty interesting figures. First of all, 2,819 was the total number of people killed in the 9/11 attacks. Per official figures, 20% is the number of Americans that knew someone injured or killed in those attacks. 26 days? Well, that's how much time had passed since 9/11 before the U.S. started bombing Afghanistan. Only 26 days. Nearly $5.3 billion? Well, that's the amount of aid the U.S. funneled to Pakistan in the 1980s during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, indirectly funding the rise of the Taliban. $5.4 billion, that is the amount of military aid the U.S. gave to Pakistan from 2002 to 2008 to help that country's military patrol the Afghan border, where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have been known to take shelter. And by the way, 70% of that aid was allegedly misspent on expenditures, such as a new house for a Pakistani general. 1,000 is the number of terrorists Pakistani officials claim to have killed between 2002 and 2008, nearly 10 the number of years that Osama bin Laden eluded capture. Less than 40, well, that's the number of minutes U.S. Special Forces spent at bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, to complete the mission that killed him. At least 9, the number of planning meetings in which Obama participated prior to the raid that killed bin Laden. 20 to 25, well, that's the number of Navy SEALs who carried out the raid mission. 0, well, that's the number of casualties sustained by U.S. forces in the raid. 3, that's the number of men in addition to bin Laden killed in the raid. One of the casualties was bin Laden's son. And 1 is the number of women used as a human shield and killed in the raid. And finally, $80 billion, that's the approximate cost of maintaining U.S. intelligence operations for 1 year. $40 billion, half of that, is the approximate cost of doing so a decade ago. And 99.9%, that's the accuracy, according to officials, of a DNA test confirming that the man shot in Abbottabad on Sunday was indeed Osama bin Laden. And now let's move from stories about bin Laden to the main stories this week in The Week magazine. And our first story from the May 6th edition is entitled The Inside Story of Guantanamo via WikiLeaks. What happened? A new trove of WikiLeaks documents on the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay this week revealed a damning litany of errors, misjudgment, and abuses since the Bush administration created the detention center for suspected terrorists in 2002. More than 150 innocent civilians, including teenage boys and illiterate Afghan shepherds and farmers, were detained for years after being deemed of little or no risk to the U.S. The 704 classified intelligence assessments obtained by WikiLeaks say, while hundreds of known terrorists were set free by mistake. The material also provided a grim picture of how some of the 779 detainees were interrogated and brutalized. One document revealed that the suspected 20th hijacker in the September 11th attacks, Mohammed al-Qahtani, was leashed like a dog, sexually humiliated and forced to urinate on himself. Some prisoners had their heads forced into toilets, while others were used as human sponges to wipe the floor. Many were beaten unconscious by interrogators. The documents say the testimony of just 8 detainees, some deemed unreliable and given to exaggerations designed to make themselves look more important, were used to justify the continued imprisonment of 255 inmates. At the same time, the documents say about 25% of the 600 released captives have rejoined al-Qaeda or other militant groups. Now here's what the editorial said. The truly shocking thing about these documents, said the London Guardian, is the desperate lack of precision shown by intelligence officers in determining which prisoners were actually terrorists. The intelligence assessments use the word possibly 387 times and unknown 188 times. Clearly, Guantanamo was and still is a dumping ground for all sorts of people, where vengeance, not justice, was the underlying goal. Because Gitmo failed as a system of justice, said the New York Times, it became a festering sore on this country's global reputation. These leaked documents have finally revealed the full scope of the legal and moral disaster that President George W. Bush created there. That problem now President Obama's, by giving each of the 172 remaining detainees a fair, credible, and transparent legal hearing, will Obama start to rebuild America's credibility as a nation of laws. In truth, said the Seattle Times, the only way to atone for Guantanamo Bay is to shut it down and try suspects in U.S. courts. We haven't seen any new prisoners there since 2007, and keeping the remaining ones locked up and out of sight is immoral and un-American. Now here's what the columnist had to say. Guantanamo Bay was absolutely necessary, said former Bush administration lawyer John Yoo in NationalReview.com, and these documents prove it. The reports show that the U.S. gleaned enormously valuable intelligence from its detainees that stopped plots and saved American lives. Interrogators were told about al-Qaeda proposals to smuggle nuclear and biological weapons into the U.S. and even to cut the cables holding up the Brooklyn Bridge. This was information that we could not have gotten anywhere else. That's what advocates of torture always say, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. In reality, the ticking time bomb, justification used by you and other Bush officials, was a slippery slope in which torture became the rule, not a rare exception. Hundreds of detainees, many of them foot soldiers or wholly innocent, were destroyed physically, psychologically, mentally, over a period of 10 years. Despite this proof of our national shame, said Glenn Greenwald in Salon.com, dozens of detainees are still being held without charges. President Obama, knowing they can't be prosecuted because the evidence against them was largely extracted from torture, has simply ordered them held indefinitely with no hope of a trial. That should repel any decent or minimally rational person. Let's remember that many of these intelligence reports go back years, said Robert Chesney in foreignpolicy.com. Today, Guantanamo Bay is no longer a lawless place with Kafkaesque procedures and detention at government whim. All detainees now have the right to challenge their detention by habeas corpus in front of a federal judge, but many have been released as a result. It's not perfect, of course, but it is a start. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week, according to The Week magazine. And this one is entitled, Taxes. Should the rich and the middle class pay more? Let's take a hike, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. The ongoing rancorous debate in Washington about our deepening fiscal crisis has omitted one very obvious reality. To be serious about balancing the federal budget, we have to raise taxes, and not just on the rich. Conservatives have made dogma of the notion that taxes must never, ever go up. But let's look at some hard facts. The Bush tax cuts are largely responsible for the trillion-dollar deficits the U.S. has been running. If we simply let those tax cuts expire for everyone in 2012, the deficit would fall dramatically right away. And over 10 years, that would trim the $3.3 trillion from the national debt. Sadly, the American ruling class is bitterly fighting any tax increase, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. In 1980, the wealthy paid an average of 34.5% of their incomes in taxes. By 2008, that figure had dropped to 23.3%, with the nation in dire fiscal straits. The wealthiest people in society have a duty to pony up more for the very government whose police power and military protect them, their property, and their wealth. Taxes aren't the answer, said the New York Post in an editorial. Contrary to the liberal myth that the wealthiest Americans aren't paying their fair share, the richest 1% of Americans currently contribute a whopping 32% of total tax revenue, up from 27.5% in 2007. The bottom 45% in terms of income pay no income tax whatsoever, making the rich shoulder an ever greater share of the tax burden. Would be morally repugnant, as well as counterproductive because it would act as a drag on the economic recovery. America spent its way into the current crisis, and only radical long-term cuts in our spending, particularly on health care, are going to rescue the nation from flooding red ink. We can't possibly cut our way out of this crisis, said David Stockman in the New York Times. Unless voters accept 20% cuts in services, defense, and benefits, which they won't, we need far more revenue. President Obama has limited his call for tax increases to those making more than $250,000 a year, just 2% of wage earners. Under this plan, the U.S. would run deficits of hundreds of billions of dollars every year indefinitely. Representative Paul Ryan's Republican alternative permanently extends the Bush tax cuts while savagely cutting benefits for the poor and the elderly, and yet he too still doesn't come close to balancing the budget. With Standard & Poor's already warning investors to be wary of U.S. Treasury bonds, this is no time for a class war between the rich and the middle class. Most of us pay higher taxes and soon or face a fiscal conflagration. Benefit cuts must be part of the solution, said Ross Dutat, also in the New York Times. The way Medicare is now structured, seniors receive far more care than they paid for during their working years, and that gap will continue to grow. It's simply not fair to burden struggling working families, entrepreneurs, and other job creators with the entire medical costs of aging baby boomers. As Ryan has suggested, the elderly must pay more for their own health care, and all social benefits must be cut. It will be painful, to be sure, but the alternative is ruinous taxes on work and success, destroying the fundamental promise of America itself. And you're listening to The Week magazine for May 6th, 2011. And now we will turn to the lighter side of the news with the popular feature, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. Well, it was a good week for finding the Holy Grail after a leaked memo said physicists at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland may have found the Higgs boson, a long-sought theoretical particle that would explain why matter has mass. The finding has yet to be confirmed. Excuse me. It was a good week for Helen Beard, a British terrorist visiting Miami, who saw a screaming one-year-old girl hanging from a fourth-floor hotel balcony, ran over, and caught the baby as she fell. And it was a good week for having strong powers of concentration after New York Public Library officials announced that viewing Internet porn on library computers is protected by the First Amendment. Even if the groaning disturbs others, customers can watch whatever they want on the computer, a library spokeswoman said. And it was a bad week for cat doors after a 7-foot-long alligator crawled through a small door used by two cats to go in and out of a Florida woman's house. Alexis Dunbar found the gator in a bedroom. It was a bad week for having that third cocktail after Hong Kong Airlines announced it is requiring its flight attendants to learn Wing Chun, a form of kung fu to subdue unruly passengers. And it was a bad week for the Orange County, Florida Fire Department after a home next door to a firehouse burned down before the firefighters could respond. This is one of the busiest fire station houses in the nation. Very, very busy, said a fire department spokesman. Obviously, we don't have people standing on the roof all night long looking for fires. And from Good Week, Bad Four, we'll turn to People News for this week from The Week magazine. Our first item here is entitled Manilow's Cornball Success. Barry Manilow has finally accepted the fact that he's just not cool, said Alan Jackson in the London Daily Mail. It's taken him 35 years, but the singer, born Barry Allen Pincus in Brooklyn, New York, is no longer troubled that sophisticated folks deem his music cheesy. Originally, he expected a different reception. Nobody could have been more surprised than I was to find I just wasn't hip, said Manilow, who is now 67. I thought I was the savior of pop, the hippest musician ever. The former commercial jingle writer certainly sold a lot of records after getting the public's attention with his first monster hit, Mandy, with its characteristically syrupy lyrics and earnest vocals. I look at my younger self now and can't help thinking how brave I was going to have to be. No one can have gotten worse reviews or been the subject of crueler jokes than I did starting out. Every critic wanted to kick me. Every comic wanted laughs at my expense. The terrible crime? Sitting at a piano, singing heartfelt songs. Those songs have made Manilow a rich man, and he continues to sell out shows in Las Vegas. Still, he can't help but be a little bit puzzled about why critics hated him so much. It's not like I'd hurt their loved ones. It was a shock anyone could be so vicious. All I cared about was the music. The next item, Walker's life-saving injury. Had Alice Walker not been blinded in one eye, she might never have become a writer, said Tim Tiemann in the London Times. Growing up in poverty in rural Georgia, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Color Purple was just 8 years old when her brother Curtis accidentally shot her with an air rifle. We were playing cowboys and Indians, and because I was a girl, I was an Indian, she recalls. I was standing on top of a makeshift garage made of corrugated tin when the pellet hit me. It was a blinding, massive sting. Only later did it really hurt. Help was delayed because Curtis tried to get her to lie about the accident. By the time the truth came out, it was too late to save the sight in that eye. I remember sitting on the porch watching the blood cover the tree I was looking at. That's the best thing I saw out of my right eye. Or the last thing that I saw out of my right eye, I should say. The accident turned out to be a blessing, though, says Walker, who is now 67. While recovering at home, she spent a lot of time reading, devouring words with her good eye, and ended up getting a scholarship to college. I got an education, she says. Curtis became a gangster. He shot people, used cocaine, and died before I had a chance to thank him. I survived, and I would have died if I had stayed there. And our next item is how Gibson defends himself. Mel Gibson doesn't blame you for hating him, said Allison Hope Weiner in Deadline.com, but he insists that he's not really the angry madman heard on the infamous audio tapes yelling racial slurs and physical threats at an ex-girlfriend, Oksana Grigoryeva. I've never treated anyone badly or in a discriminatory way based on their gender, race, religion, or sexuality, period, Gibson says. I don't blame some people for thinking that, though from the garbage they heard on those leaked tapes, which have been edited, You have to put it all in the proper context of being in an irrationally heated discussion at the height of a breakdown, trying to get out of a really unhealthy relationship. It's one terribly awful moment in time, said to one person in the span of one day, and doesn't represent how I've treated people my entire life. Nonetheless, he says he deeply regrets the humiliation he's caused his children and is resigned to the fact that his career, already badly damaged by his drunken anti-Semitic rant during a 2006 DUI arrest, may be over. I don't care if I ever act again. It's not a problem. And now let's turn to the briefing in the Week magazine for this week, and this particular edition is entitled The Origin of the Birthers. Until this week, 45% of Republicans believe the president was born outside the U.S. How did this rumor start? What do birthers believe? That Barack Obama does not meet the requirement laid out in Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution that the president be a natural-born citizen. Most think Obama was born in Kenya, his father's birthplace, or in Indonesia, where he lived from 1967 to 1971. Many just suspect the president is hiding something about the circumstances of his birth, be it his birthplace, his religion, or his father's true identity. After 2 years of rumors and controversy, Obama finally released his original long-form birth certificate this week, which should put an end to the issue. But birthers won't surrender easily because of their conviction that a man with the president's foreign-sounding name, dark skin, and liberal views can't be an American. If it could be proved that Obama was born outside the United States, conservative columnist Matt Patterson wrote recently, then the legitimacy of anything he has signed into law would be instantly questionable. When did the question first surface? In June 2008, after Obama locked up the Democratic nomination for president. In an attempt to counter chatter that Obama's real middle name was Mohammed, his aides released a copy of his Hawaiian certification of live birth, which stated that Barack Hussein Obama II was born in Honolulu on August 4, 1961. But that document only fueled further suspicion. In August 2008, lifelong Democrat Philip J. Berg, a former Pennsylvania Deputy Attorney General, filed the first lawsuit alleging that Obama is not a natural-born U.S. citizen. It was dismissed as frivolous and not worthy of discussion, but the rumor continued to grow. A CBS New York Times survey conducted in mid-April found that 45% of registered Republicans believe the president was not born in the U.S. Why weren't they convinced? Well, until this week, Obama had provided only the certification of live birth from the state of Hawaii, not the original long-form certificate of live birth. That had been kept in a bound volume at the State Department of Health. The former director of that department, appointed by a Republican governor, twice examined and confirmed the authenticity of the original birth certificate. Employees of FactCheck.org did the same. Two Hawaiian newspapers had carried announcements of Obama's birth in August 1961, and the state's current governor, Democrat Neil Abercrombie, recalls congratulating Obama's parents on the birth of their son. "I knew his mom and dad," he said. "I was here when he was born." That didn't settle it? Well, no. Birthers insisted that only the original long-form birth certificate would do. They noted that FactCheck.org's major funding comes from the Annenberg Foundation, which also backed the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, an educational initiative on whose board Obama once served. The connection is strong enough in my mind to raise reasonable questions about the objectivity of FactCheck.org in matters regarding Obama, Patterson wrote. Do birthers have evidence of their own? They've produced alternative birth certificates that have turned out to be forgeries. Berg supplied one listing Canada as Obama's birthplace, but he withdrew it after a close examination revealed it had been signed by one Dudley Do-Right. Another vocal birther, Los Angeles dentist Orly Tates, produced a Kenyan birth certificate issued by the Republic of Kenya, which didn't yet exist when the certificate was supposedly printed in February 1964. Tate says the document was forged to try to discredit my efforts, Birthers also claim Obama's grandmother admitted in a taped interview that he was born in Kenya. But in the full, unedited tape, she says, through a translator, that she was not present at his birth. "Sir," she says, "he was born in Hawaii," the translator says. Why did Obama wait so long to provide the original? Well, he and his aides and supporters believe that any serious attempt to satisfy the birthers' demands would grant them a legitimacy they didn't deserve. And they feared that releasing the original certificate would only spark a new wave of suspicion and conspiracy theories. Any additional statement of clarification is a contradiction or leaves unanswered questions, said John Berryhill, an Obama supporter who spends much of his time countering birther rumors online. But when Donald Trump got national attention for openly questioning Obama's birth, the White House gave in. Will that end it? Well, not for the hardcore birthers. They suspect the long-form certificate is a forgery. As one of them wrote on FoxNews.com this week, "This just smells." The newly released certificate, the skeptic continued, is in immaculate condition for being back in 1961. "Impressive looks more like 2008. Said another, "I don't believe it for a minute. This is just another sideshow for Obama to lie to the American people. Obama," he said, "is an imposter." Having it both ways. Well, most Republican presidential contenders have declined to disavow the birthers, choosing carefully worded statements that signal ambiguity. Michelle Bachmann has been using the standard GOP formulation, saying, "I take the president at his word." Sarah Palin said last month that Obama was born in Hawaii, but added that obviously there's something there that the president doesn't want people to see on that birth certificate. When former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee was asked why we don't have a birth certificate for Obama, he said, "Would love to know more, but what we know is troubling enough." The next day, his spokesman said Huckabee was saying only that he would like to know more about where the president's liberal policies come from. Donald Trump has been the only candidate to embrace the birthers outright, hailing them as really great American people. He told Bill O'Reilly first that Obama doesn't have a birth certificate, then later allowed that he may have one, but there is something on that birth certificate, maybe religion, maybe it says he's a Muslim, I don't know. In recent polls, Trump's popularity among Republican voters soared, and until this week at least, he was tied with Huckabee for the most support. And now from the Week magazine, let us turn to the best columns of the week, according to the editors of the week. The first one is "How Roe Became Irrelevant" by Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. "Roe versus Wade is no longer the law of the land," said Dahlia Lithwick. The landmark 1973 Supreme Court ruling, which forbids states to outlaw abortions, has not been overturned and probably never will be. But it's gradually being worn away by a host of invasive, paternalistic, and degrading state regulations that will soon make it all but impossible to terminate a pregnancy in many states. Already this year, 7 states have enacted laws to regulate abortion by, for example, extending waiting periods or forcing women to listen to a detailed verbal description of their fetus. More than 900 other restrictions have been introduced in 49 states. The majority of these restrictions contravene Roe, but pro-choice activists won't legally challenge these clearly unconstitutional laws for fear the conservative-leaning Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade altogether. The court's conservative wing, meanwhile, is perfectly content to see Roe killed by 1,000 cuts, because if it issued a ruling making all abortions illegal again, Republicans would suffer a huge political backlash. The result, a country where abortion is technically legal but is almost entirely unavailable to poor women who live in conservative states. The next item is entitled "Lowering the Drinking Age to 18" by Michelle Minton in the National Review. "It's time to lower the drinking age," said Michelle Minton. The federal law that forced all 50 states to establish 21 as the legal drinking age has backfired and created a culture of hidden drinking and disrespect for the law. In a country where 18-year-olds can vote, marry, and go to war, they should be able to buy and drink a beer without breaking the law. It's true that America has a problem with drinking, but the rates of alcoholism and binge drinking among teenagers are far greater there than in Europe, where teenagers can legally drink. Here, teens learn to drink by furtively guzzling beer or booze in basements, the woods, or college dorm rooms without adult supervision, rather than drink slowly and moderately for pleasure. They race to get drunk. Advocacy groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving contend that raising the drinking age has reduced alcohol-fueled highway fatalities. But fatalities have dropped for all age groups and in other countries, too, primarily because of better auto safety technology. In every way except one, our society treats 18-year-olds as adults. It's time to end the hypocrisy. And the final column from the Week magazine's designated Best Columns of the Week is The Bogus Threat of Internet Porn by Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. It's widely believed that wherever X-rated fare gains popularity, social decay will follow, said Steve Chapman. That's why 42 senators, led by Utah Republican Orrin Hatch, have responded with outrage to Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to dismantle a Bush-era task force set up to go after hardcore material on the Internet. But let's examine the facts. The last two decades have been to electronic erotica what Thanksgiving is to gluttony. Today, one out of three Americans with Internet access regularly visits porn sites. The state with the highest rate of subscription to porn sites? Utah. And yet there is a zero evidence that viewing porn hurts individuals or society. Since 1991, the number of rapes has dropped by 86%. The divorce rate has fallen by 25%. As for sex addicts, yes, there are a few, just as there are addicts of fantasy baseball, alcohol, and the lottery. So what gives the government the right to decide what adults can view on their home computers? If we can tolerate racist literature, slasher videos, and the Westboro Baptist Church, we can put up with adult entertainers at their most indiscreet. And now we'll turn to the end of the magazine, The Week, for the final word. This week we're going to talk about baseball. The title is The End of the Streak. 70 summers ago, Joe DiMaggio hit safely in 56 straight games. This is the story of that 57th game. The fans arrived early, herding together outside Cleveland's vast municipal stadium, spilling in a great throng onto Lakeside Drive. The weather had broken clear, and a mild evening breeze blew off Lake Erie. By the time the Yankees took batting practice, fans had crowded into the double-decker grandstand and the outfielder bleachers. Down in the infield seats, there was scarcely room to move in the aisles. A few had come to see Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak stopped by their Indians, but many wanted to see it continue. And some people, like Cleveland's ace pitcher Bob Feller, felt both things at once. He couldn't quite bring himself to root for DiMaggio to get a hit against his team, but at the same time as he sat in the dugout looking out at the great, soughing crowd, Feller found himself thinking, "I'd sure like to get a crack at stopping that streak tomorrow. I'd like to be the one on the mound." What pitcher wouldn't? The Yankee Clipper, as DiMaggio was known, had hit successfully in 56 straight games, a feat unequaled before or since in modern baseball. For 2 months in the tense summer of 1941, as the Nazis marched relentlessly through Europe and hundreds of thousands of young men were drafted, America was captivated by DiMaggio's streak. Great crowds came out to see the Yankees, and there was excitement each time DiMaggio stepped up to bat. Whoever finally shut him down would be known forever as the pitcher who stopped Superman. The Indians' Al Smith, tonight's starter, was a skinny and left-handed kid and threw a lot of soft stuff. He rarely appeared excited. His teammates called him Silent Al. Ground still wet, DiMaggio thought as he took his batting stance in the top of the first inning. Might be a slog to first base. Rain had fallen earlier in the day, and he could feel the mud sticking to his spikes. The Yankees already led 1-0. With one out, Tommy Henrich stood on second base. Smith started DiMaggio with a fastball, missing high and away. At third base, Ken Keltner shifted his weight, rubbed the palm of his glove, resumed his crouch. He approached the art of fielding assiduously, positioning himself carefully and differently for each batter. Against DiMaggio, he played very deep and near the foul line. I would rather have him sneak a single through the hole than put a double past me, Keltner reasoned. Smith's second pitch was a curveball that broke to the inside corner of the plate. DiMaggio lashed at it, pulling the ball hard and on the ground down that third base line. It zipped fair past the bag, then into foul territory. Keltner backhanded the ball, straightened his body, and threw a pellet to the first baseman, Oscar Grimes. DiMaggio, on a close play, was out. Cheers erupted from the stands. Did you see that play? Best third baseman in the league, I tell you. Would have been a double. When the half inning ended, applause thundered down again on Keltner as he trotted off the field. In the top of the fourth, the score was still 1-0. Smith had run the count to 3-2 on DiMaggio. Smith relied on his curveball, changeup, middling fastball, and a screwball that could fool you. What he really had going for him was the element of surprise. He would use any of his pitches at any time. He threw a full count changeup, and DiMaggio fouled it into the stands. Still 3-2. Hang back on this guy, DiMaggio said to himself. You can always adjust to that fastball. The curveball that followed bent too far inside. DiMaggio restrained himself and did not swing. Ball four. Boos rained out of the crowd. Walking a hitter on a streak like this, even unintentionally, was rotten play. DiMaggio was now hitless in two times at the plate. Swiftly, the game moved along. The grandstand shook when the Indians' G. Walker tied the game at 1-1 with an inside-the-park home run in the bottom of the fourth inning. A mist floating in off the lake, mixed with the cigarette smoke that wafted from the stands, blurring the arc lights together. Smith was handling the Yankees fairly easily, and Lefty Gomez on the hill for the Yanks had his stuff, too. Top of the seventh, one out and no one on base. Score still tied at 1-1. I'm going up swinging this time, DiMaggio thought. The Cleveland crowd had swung DiMaggio's way for this at-bat, rooting for him to get a single and then to stay stranded at first. It was time to get what they had paid for, to witness the great man perform. Smith's first-pitch curveball arrived waist-high and again bent inside. DiMaggio swung, and the ball whipped down the third-base line. Again, Keltner backhanded it. No one goes to his right better than this guy, Feller thought, stood and threw across his body and across the diamond to get DiMaggio by a stride. That's twice, DiMaggio thought, jogging back to the bench. Keltner has my number. The next batter, Joe Gordon, homered to give the Yankees a 2-1 lead. And now it was the eighth inning, and Smith was tiring badly. The Yankees, on a long rally, had lengthened their lead to 4-1. Smith walked Henrich to load the bases with one out, bringing up DiMaggio. Cleveland manager Roger Peckinpah came out of the dugout. He waved for the tall right-hander Jim Bagby Jr. to come in from the bullpen. DiMaggio knelt on his right knee in front of the Yankees' dugout and watched Bagby warm up. Bagby's father had also pitched in the majors, and in 1920 he had won 31 games for the Indians. Junior, though, had done nothing close to that. He had less than a .500 record over four so-so seasons. He threw a decent fastball, though, especially compared with Al Smith's, and he liked to keep it down. In the on-deck circle, DiMaggio rose and swung his two bats at a few times and then tossed one of them away. The bases were loaded in the eighth, and this would almost certainly be his final turn at bat. In such moments, in the still center of a roiling, noisy crowd, DiMaggio's wide, unflinching stance appeared especially calm, even ceremonial. Bagby reared back and threw a fastball an inch or two outside for a ball. The next pitch was another fastball, inside this time, that DiMaggio fouled off. Then came a curveball that broke wide. 2-1. Now it was the fastball again, this one at the knees. DiMaggio swung and caught the top half of the ball, sending it on the ground right to Lou Boudreau at shortstop. Just before reaching Boudreau, the ball struck something in the grass and leapt upward. Boudreau raised his glove to catch it at shoulder height, using his bare hand to help. He shuffled the ball to second baseman Ray Mack, who threw it to Grimes at first. The double play was complete, and the eighth inning was over. From the dugout, manager Joe McCarthy and the rest of the Yankees watched DiMaggio as the Cleveland crowd cheered loudly and the Indians came bouncing off the field. Everyone looked to see what DiMaggio would do. The streak was surely finished. Yet he did only what he would have done at any other time. After crossing the first base bag, DiMaggio slowed from his sprint, then turned to his left and continued running out toward shallow center field, where he bent and, still moving, plucked his glove off the grass. He did not kick the earth or shake his head or pound his fist into the saddle of the glove. He did not behave as if he were aware of the volume and frenzy of the crowd. He did not look directly at anyone or anything. For the rest of the game, in the dugout, DiMaggio remained by himself, an invisible cone around him. Then in the bottom of the ninth inning, Indians hitters singled twice off Gomez, and the starter left the game. With Johnny Murphy in to pitch for the Yankees, pinch hitter Larry Rosenthal tripled. The Yankees still led 4-3 with nobody out, but if one of the next three Cleveland hitters could knock in Rosenthal, the game might go into extra innings. DiMaggio might get another chance. But a ground ball to Johnny Sturm at first base kept Rosenthal on third for the first out. The next batter, Soup Campbell, chopped one back to Murphy, who caught Rosenthal off base and trapped him in a rundown. Out number two. Roy Weatherly's ground out, also straight to Sturm, ended that game. DiMaggio ran in briskly to the dugout and clacked up the runway to the clubhouse. Although the Yankees had won a tight and important game and had all but put a lock on the pennant, the locker room remained hushed. DiMaggio took off his cap and tossed his glove into his locker. The other players all made like they were attending to something important at their own stalls. Not even Gomez, high on his sixth straight win, had anything to say. Through the walls, you could hear and feel the rumble of the fans. DiMaggio sat on his stool, silent. "Well," he said finally, "that's over." It happened again, then, the towels thrown his way and the gloves tossed jauntily in the air, and the guys gathering close and happy around him. "Tough luck, Dag. Thought you had one past Keltner." "Suppose it had to end sometime," DiMaggio said. Manager McCarthy threw an arm around him. "You'll start another one tomorrow," he said. For the photographers, Joe posed with his thumbs and four fingers held up in circles, zeros symbolic of his hitless night. The news spread over the radio, and the next day across the country, the end of the streak headlines would run above all else. A cartoon showed Smith and Bagby as submarines in the high seas, firing away and sinking the Yankee Clipper. Gradually, the Yankees' clubhouse began to clear out. DiMaggio, though, was slow to move. He sat on his stool in his uniform and smoked a couple of cigarettes. The room had grown quiet again, and the Indians' clubhouse boy, an Italian kid named Frank, kept his eyes on DiMaggio. "Scooter, stick around for me, will you?" DiMaggio said to his teammate, Phil Rizzuto. Finally, DiMaggio had buttoned his white shirt and clipped his suspenders and snapped straight the sleeves of his suit. The two players nodded goodbye to Frank, and then, more than 2 hours after the final play of the game, DiMaggio and Rizzuto stepped out into the night. The crowd had by now given up and gone home. There was no one hanging around to pester Joe. In silence, DiMaggio and Rizzuto began to walk through the moist night air beneath the lampposts and up the hill toward the Hotel Cleveland. In the weeks and months and years that followed, DiMaggio would think back on the time of the streak, just as so many others in so many places would recall that hot, strange summer before the war and would tell their children and their children's children about what DiMaggio had done. And just as the record keepers would log the hitting streak above all others, year after year after year, and all through the decades of DiMaggio's life, and he would know that in that time he had burst the bounds of the game, and that he had done something that would live with him always, exalting, something crowning and indelible. 56. And that is from the book called 56, Joe DiMaggio and the Last Magic Number in Sports, by Kostya Kennedy. And, of course, we read it from the week, using it with permission and all rights reserved. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for May 6th, 2011. Thanks very much for joining me today. Now let's turn to talking points. The first item here is entitled, The Wedding, Can Kate Save the Monarchy? Every marriage takes work, said John Burns in the New York Times, but by becoming Princess Catherine, the former Kate Middleton has taken on the added burden of saving the anachronism of the monarchy in a democratic age. The British are still reasonably fond of their royal family, but the institution was badly damaged by the disastrous marriage of Prince Charles and Diana Spencer, with its multiple affairs, its intercepted phone calls with excruciating expressions of sexual yearning for other people, and its awful soap opera ending. Indeed, a long series of embarrassing divorces and personal and financial scandals have shaken the royal family's foundations as never before in modern times. Can Kate, along with her new husband, Prince William, rebrand the inept family of oddballs for the 21st century? Well, so far, Kate has not made a single false step, said Lauren Collins in The New Yorker. She has expertly climbed Britain's social ladder, emerging from a middle-class family of arrivists, who became wealthy and through a party supply business. At posh Marlborough College, Kate's friends say she put up a poster of William on her dorm room wall like a target before the two met and fell in love. When they briefly broke up, Kate kept her mouth shut, gave William the space he craved, and went out on the town in a spray-on miniskirt. Sure enough, he came back. Most important of all, Kate knows that her public role is to look beautiful and let William take the lead, unlike Diana, who hogged the spotlight. Queen Catherine, as she one day will be, seems to have what it takes, said Andrew Roberts in the London Spectator. The snobs who are aghast that William chose a commoner will soon be lost in admiration of her poise and her professionalism. Still, I pity her, said Christopher Hitchens in Slate.com. Every decade or so, the pathetic bunch of scandal-prone, dowdy misanthropes Britain calls the royals seems to require a human sacrifice, a fresh-faced outsider like Diana or Kate, who is forced to live an unendurable existence of constant scrutiny, and then is punished or humiliated when they crack up. If I could offer the newlywed Kate one piece of advice, it would be to flee this gilded cage before it destroys her. If you really love him, honey, get him out of there, and yourself too. Hell. A pastor argues that it doesn't exist. Well, what if hell doesn't exist? Well, that's the provocative question posed by Michigan megachurch pastor Rob Bell in a book that has ignited a new holy war in Christian circles and beyond, said John Meacham in Time. In Love Wins, Bell argues that the concept of a fiery pit into which all non-Christians will be thrown is theologically rigid, outdated, and dangerous. What kind of loving God, he asked, would only save those within the confines of his church? Would he really throw Gandhi into everlasting fire because he was a Hindu? Instead, Bell suggests that the redemptive work of Jesus may be universal, and that every soul might be guaranteed a place in heaven. Not surprisingly, evangelicals have erupted in outrage at Bell's universalist treatise, accusing him of heresy and blasphemy. One Christian blogger dubbed him a tool of Satan. Evangelicals have every right to be furious, said Janice Shaw Krause in the Washington Times. Bell may think he's trying to modernize Christianity, but he's actually undermining it. How can a Christian leader argue that accepting Christ is unnecessary? When everyone is free to make up their own theology, the church becomes both impotent and irrelevant. Believing in universal salvation may fit with the modern world's anything-goes ethos, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But if we are guaranteed a place in paradise, no matter what we do, then what use is free will? Without hell, all our actions are like home runs or strikeouts in a children's game where nobody's keeping score. Bell isn't opposed to keeping score on people's actions, said Richard Mao in the Christian Post. He simply wants Christians to question the stingy orthodoxy that says that billions of our fellow human beings will go to hell because their beliefs differ from our own. Bell contends that everyone is worthy of God's love if they do not explicitly choose to reject it. And for what it's worth, says Krista Tippett in the Washington Post, Bell does in fact offer a vision of hell in his book. It's just not the primitive notion of a netherworld of wailing sinners. Instead, it's a symbol of the evil and chaos that comes from moving away from God, the hells on earth that we see in war-torn and violent societies. The real hell is all around us, he says, and it's time that we Christians stopped ignoring it. And now, as we near the end of the program here, let's take a look at a few shorter items from Talking Points. Under the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, which is still on the books in the United Kingdom, the reigning monarch, currently Queen Elizabeth II, must approve any marriage involving the royal family. And that was from the New Yorker magazine, by the way. Japan is now creating suicide hotlines and sending mental health counselors into the region affected by the tsunami and nuclear crisis out of fear there will be a surge of self-inflicted deaths. The Japanese, whose culture romanticizes suicide, already have a suicide rate more than double that of the U.S. It's the leading cause of death there among men ages 20 to 44 and women ages 15 to 34. U.S. consumers spend $1.2 trillion on non-essential goods and services annually, according to the Commerce Department. Consumer spending on discretionary luxury items, including jewelry, yachts, sports cars, alcoholic beverages, and candy, has risen 11.2% of total consumer spending, and that's up 4% from back in 1959. And the poll watch this week, 55% of American drivers say they're changing their driving habits as a result of high gas prices. 36% say recent events in the Middle East are to blame for the high prices, while 33% blame oil companies. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. We had a lot to cover this week. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.